You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 14th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, talking about mountaintop removal and the Ache Act. Bob Kincaid of Head On Radio will be joining us. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Also today, more on the pick of Paul Ryan as Mitt Romney's vice presidential nominee. I will continue to opine on the reasons why he was picked. But more importantly, and particularly for those of us who have not been terribly enthused about this coming election, I will discuss how Ryan provides a great opportunity for those of us who want to protect Social Security and Medicare following an Obama victory in the fall, and of course, the years to come. We'll get to that story about how actually preventing kids from eating crap makes them healthier. I know, shocking in this day and age. Another story about a nuclear power plant that shut down. Well, a reactor that was shut down. Why, and just how ridiculous the way in which this thing was reported. Robo-signing coming to a credit card bill dispute near you. And Mitt Romney continues, despite the fact that he's made this bold pick, to be a complete idiot. And his campaign is a joke. Etc. Etc. Oh, where to start? I hadn't even thought about that. You know, folks, it's less than 24 hours. Well, it's now, I guess, 24 hours since I've been back from vacation. I mean, who am I kidding? It's 48 hours. I'm still hanging on to my vacation in a, with a bare knuckled. Well, let's just talk about this story first, and then we'll get to Bob. Story in the New York Times, relevant in terms of our discussion about those big sodas that Matt was so upset that he can't buy in New York City anymore, and also on those who those libertarians who don't like their freedom infringed upon, and how it would be an affront to that. Who was that guy in that Mel Gibson movie who yelled freedom? William, I can't remember. Isn't that their cry, the libertarians? Or is it Wolverines in Red Dawn? I can't remember. It's hard. I'm a fan of both those movies, and apparently, Red Dawn is in the works, folks. It's coming. New York Times, adolescents in states. is according to a study published in the journal Pediatrics, which I'm sure most of you are avid readers of. Adolescents in states with strict laws regulating the sale of snacks and sugary drinks in public schools gained less weight over a 3-year period than those living in states with no such laws, according to the study. Is this earth-shattering? Should this come as a shock to you? No, but it's nice to have some evidence that, in fact, if you do not make these available to children, sugar being an incredibly addictive substance, children, and frankly, I mean, not just children, Nikki left a huge chocolate bar in the freezer. She and Milo are out of town, and basically, you know, come 10 o'clock at night at my house, all I can do is just eat it. And then I got to try it with peanut butter on top, and then like, wait, what does it taste like with almond butter on top? It found a strong association. Now, it's not direct evidence. That's not exactly the way that science works. A strong association between healthier weight and tough state laws regulating food in vending machines, snack bars, and other venues that were not part of the regular school meal programs. These other foods are known as competitive foods because they compete with the school breakfast and lunches menus. Study tracked weight changes for 6,300 students in 40 states between 2004 and 2007, following them into fifth grade. The study stopped short of saying the stronger laws were directly responsible for the better outcomes. It concluded only that such outcomes tended to happen in states with stronger laws. But the correlation was substantial. Over a 3-year period, students who lived in those states gained an average of 0.44 fewer body mass index units, or 2.25 fewer pounds for a 5-foot-tall child than adolescents in states with no policies. Is it dramatic? I don't know. I'm not a nutritionist. But there's a strong correlation that by not offering kids crappy foods where it's readily available for them, it makes them somewhat healthier. Now you could say, well, that benefit doesn't outweigh the infringement upon these children's freedom to eat this crap. But I, for one, think better health outcomes are better. I mean, they also don't have the freedom to just eat a bag of sugar because it's not available there. So really what you're talking about is we're infringing upon the sellers of this crap, much of which we subsidize through our food policy by making corn so cheap, to profit off of feeding these kids crap. And I'm sorry, I'm not so worried about our freedoms in that case. There's a whole other raft of freedoms that we are losing that are far more important in my estimation. But I'm not Paul Ryan. So, all right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Bob Kincaid. He'll be talking to us about the AIC Act, mountaintop mining, and other sundry issues. We'll be right back after this.
Like capital is, like
real pleasure to welcome to the program. Oh, I should say Sam Cedar back on the Majority Report, and it's a real pleasure to welcome to the program Bob Kincaid. He is a founding one of the founders of the Appalachian Health Community Campaign, and of course a progressive talker on HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you very kindly. I appreciate the chance to talk a little bit about what we're working on here in Appalachia.
Yeah, tell us now. First off, give people why did you start the Appalachian Health Community Campaign?
Well, I've been active in the struggle against mountaintop removal, the basic struggle for human rights in Appalachia, for several years now. And within the last few years, some science has begun coming out that makes it abundantly clear that mountaintop removal coal extraction is actually poisoning innocent people in Appalachia all the way from in the womb to old age. It's inescapable. And with this science behind us, we decided that this was the very best way to really finally put an end to this and bring some semblance of rights to people in this tormented region.
Now, hopefully everybody out here has watched The Last Mountain. It's an unbelievable documentary, and I don't know that people really have a full sense of just how devastating mountaintop removal is, not just to the environment, and it is incredibly devastating to the environment, and how devastating it is to the communities around there, both in terms of the physical structure, the fiber of these communities, and to the health of these people. Obviously, you're talking specifically about now, but just give us a sense of the sort of the environmental and community impact aside from health. And then we'll get to those health concerns.
Sure, absolutely. Everybody knows that Timothy McVeigh used a mixture of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives when he blew up the Murrah Federal Building. Well, imagine that in excess of 700 Timothy McVeigh explosions go off in West Virginia every day. We're talking about 5 million pounds of high explosives on mountaintops throughout central Appalachia, taking down the oldest mountains on Earth as 1,000 feet to get at seams of coal that are sometimes 6 inches to a foot thick. And this goes on over thousands of acres. If we were to aggregate everything that mountaintop removal has done thus far, the state of Delaware would be gone. That's how much they've blown up, in excess of that square mileage or square acreage. It poisons the air. It poisons the streams. It eliminates communities. It's actually devastated the economy because it doesn't require many people to work on it. 14 or 15 people can take down a mountaintop removal complex that is 5,000 acres in just a matter of a few years. It puts selenium, arsenic, barium, mercury, cadmium, manganese, magnesium, aluminum, the whole heavy metal spectrum of the periodic table of the elements basically is just pumped into our world on a daily basis. It works out to the explosives used work out to be somewhere around 1.6 billion pounds of those high explosives every day. If this was happening any other place in the country, we'd swear that somebody was making war on us, Sam.
And I'll tell you, I'm going to be talking to Chris Hedges tomorrow, and he's got a new book out today, recently, I should say, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, and he talks about these sacrifice zones. And one of those zones he talks about are parts of West Virginia, which he mentions about four others around the country, but they are zones where essentially corporations have come in and have plundered, I mean, just completely raped these areas, both of not just of their natural resources, but of the resources of the humanity there. And there is no better example of corporations that essentially are externalizing their costs
to the people that are in the immediate vicinity. And frankly, when we're talking about coal, they're externalizing their costs to all of us in burning this stuff that, poisons our environment with mercury and like you mentioned, all of these other chemicals. And this is an area that is just has been traditionally incredibly poor, and also because of that, incredibly underrepresented. Their interests are completely cast aside, and it's left people just devastated, hasn't it?
Oh, it absolutely has. Consider, for instance, the congressional district where I live, Sam. It is one of the top or bottom, depending on how you look at it, five congressional districts in the country in terms of general well-being and health. And yet my member of Congress, who is a Democrat even ostensibly, wants more mountaintop removal and not less. The sickest district in the United States is run by Republican or is represented by Republican Hal Rogers of Kentucky. And again, he wants more poisoning, not less. This is long-term ecologic, environmental, and to my mind, most importantly, human health degradation on a massive scale. If this continues until they get the last little scrap of coal out of the ground, Sam, we're going to be talking about a toxic waste zone that encompasses an entire region of the country.
Because as it's also, you know, I mean, people, I know there's a tendency to say, like, well, we've been pulling coal out of the ground for decades upon decades. Why is it necessarily worse now? One of the things that has been clear, and I think it's also, and I know this also gets to sort of the methodology that they're using, but one of the things that has become clear over the past a couple years is that for the miners themselves, we're seeing a lot more cases of black lung disease.
Absolutely. They've found it among the mountaintop removal workers themselves now, which came as a bit of a surprise because that was one of the lies that they used to tell, that it was somehow safer for people working on the sites to do mountaintop removal than it was to go underground. That has been shown to be an outright falsehood.
And I know that within the mines, you know, we had about I guess it was in the late 1960s, there was some regulation in there to protect miners from black lung disease. I'm not going to say it eradicated it, but it certainly curtailed it. And those numbers have gone back up starting in the 90s, partially because of lax regulation, partly because these mine companies are cheating and there's less regulatory enforcement, partly because of the way that they are they're now extracting these things. So we have had essentially no progress and really a deterioration in many respects from where we were just 30 years ago.
Absolutely. And it's, as I noted, it is going to continue. The fact of the matter is, if you want to talk about the workers' end of it, about 1,000 miners still die every year from black lung. And ask anybody in the occupational safety business, they'll tell you that no one should die of black lung. It is entirely a preventable disease.
So we've got a situation here where we have these corporations and this industry is completely taking advantage of their workers. Now let's talk about what's happening to the people who live in that area and your organization's pushing of the AIC Act. Tell us what the AIC Act is.
Well, the AIC Act was born out of the campaign that we started, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, the AIC campaign. It's a consortium of a number of individuals and groups, like the group that I work with, Coal River Mountain Watch, as well as Christians for the Mountains, Mountain Health and Heritage Association. And what we did is we banded together to take this health data that has come out that shows, for instance, out of a survey of 1.8 million live births in Appalachia between 1996 and 2003, there are stunning levels of birth defect increases the closer you get to a mountaintop removal community. In the adult population and the extant child population, we're seeing clusters and weird, anomalous, bizarre cancers pop up in communities that happen to be near mountaintop removal operations. We found out that the very soil we live on is contaminated with these things called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAH toxins, which are just a laundry list of carcinogens that land on our soil because of the explosives used on these sites. And as a consequence of all of this data coming out, we decided that, and we've tried everything, Sam. We've begged the president. We've begged the administrative agencies. We have protested. We've demonstrated. We've been arrested. We've done everything in our power to bring attention to this. So we decided that maybe what we needed was a law. And working with folks like Dennis Kucinich and Louise Slaughter and John Conyers and John Yarmuth and Raul Grijalva and a number of the other co-sponsors of the AACA Act, we have crafted a bill that actually says we're going to use real science, like President Obama said. He said he was going to rely on science. We're going to use real science to find out why it is that people living near these nightmare demolition zones have to be sacrificed for corporate profits. So that was H.R. 5959, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, was introduced in the Congress of the United States on June the 19th. We've got 18 co-sponsors now, and we are adamant that we want more. And I'd like to say, Sam, that I think that this is a bipartisan issue because the Republicans are forever being concerned about the unborn babies in the womb. Well, what could be clearer than to stop something that's an obvious assault on them?
And so, I mean, what do you do next? You get more sponsors? I mean, obviously, there's no chance of a legislation passing before the election. So presumably we're talking a slightly longer horizon. What are the next steps that need to be taken?
Well, we're going to work all the way up to the very end of this Congress trying to get more co-sponsors on so that when the new Congress comes in, we will have a good core of people to reintroduce the bill and take it forward. And eventually we'll move with our work over into the Senate as well. There are a lot of instances in American history where activists had to wait until legislation was passed. One of the things that comes to mind is the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain in West Virginia. Very few people know about it. It was a horrifying event. The government went to war against its own people. But they had to wait. Labor was crushed in West Virginia until 1934, 1935, when the Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act. Well, we don't have that long, but we do recognize that the legislative process is the one process that can end this once and for all. So that's how we go forward, and we hope to build a whole lot more support going into the next Congress. So all the activity, all the action we can get, all the co-signers we can get now means it's that much stronger when it's reintroduced.
Give us a sense of on the ground, I mean, in the state, like what are the dynamics there? I mean, are there more people becoming aware of this? I mean, what are the who are the forces? Obviously, the corporations don't want this. And obviously, the politicians who are funded by these people, want to keep this. Keep these type of movements down. But when you're talking about the citizens of West Virginia, I mean, how do the lines break down? Are just people just not aware of what's going on up there? Do they not care? Is it a sort of a classic sense of ignoring those people who live up there? I mean, give me a sense of how it breaks down.
Well, the coal companies and their political creatures would have you believe that people are either ignorant of it or don't or approve of it. Nothing could be further from the truth. There was polling data about a year ago that shows across party lines and across demographic lines, gender lines, every line you can imagine, people are in central Appalachia, people are aware of mountaintop removal, and they resoundingly want it ended. This is a situation where politics and its merger with business have completely occluded the representative quality of our political process. So, no, people are very much aware of it. This is, however, a very polarized region, such that if one dares to speak out against it, the coal side in this struggle is not shy about making threats, doing overt violence, and doing everything they can to shut us up. Unfortunately for them, we refuse.
Is this? I mean, is it polarized in the region as well? I mean, are there communities where this is split? I mean, I can imagine scenarios where people work for the coal companies and are like, you know, still walking through their town and seeing that there is, sort of absurdly high numbers of people with cancer and sort of closing their eyes to it. I mean, give us a sense of that.
They do exactly that, Sam. But it is an extremely polarized area and an extremely polarizing issue. We've had peaceful, nonviolent demonstrations where members of the where coal industry supporters have crossed into our nonviolent space and physically assaulted people who were merely sitting on the ground. I've been threatened. Most of my colleagues at one time or another have been threatened and violence. It's frightening, but when you're dealing with stakes as high as these are, that kind of threatening conduct can't allow us to be stopped, because this is actually a 100% existential struggle. Mm. So, yeah, it's difficult, and yes, it's frightening, but if we allow ourselves to be silenced, then we know that we are condemning not just this generation, but the next generation and the one beyond that. I'm an eighth generation Appalachian, and the 10th generation is of my family is sleeping in a cradle right now. So I can't let thuggish behavior silence me in the face of me knowing what the sentence is that they are imposing on innocent toddlers.
Well, Bob, I appreciate the work you're doing down there. Where can people go to get more information?
The best place to go, Sam, is acheact.org. That's acheact.org. There are links there to all the science papers. You can learn everything you could possibly want to know about the health impacts of mountaintop removal on our communities and on our families, on our colleagues, our neighbors, and our loved ones. There's a PayPal button there if you want to help out. We've got a campaign that's moving relentlessly in Washington, D.C., and also, you know, we're reaching out to audiences like yours, asking them to go to the website, go to your congressperson, demand that they sign on to H.R. 5959. And, the New York Times called what mountaintop removal Appalachia's agony. And we'd like to end that agony, Sam.
And people should understand, too, that it's going to be easier for your congresspeople who live outside of that area to sign on to this bill, because they don't have necessarily the same, financial pressures. If you're a congressperson from New York City, you may have to kowtow in some respects to the financial industry, but not necessarily to the coal mining industry. And so this is one of those situations where a national push can really help. So it's acheact.org. We'll have the link on majority.fm. Bob, once again, I really appreciate the work you're doing, and thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much, Sam. We appreciate it more than you know.
All right, Bob. Bob Kincaid, folks. Again, it's acheact.org. Thanks for coming on. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye now.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, a little more Paul Ryan ranting. Because I really do think there is an opportunity here for progressives, even those of us who are not so keyed up about this election. But more on that when we return.
Every day I get up and pray to John. Number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there was
So as I was mentioning yesterday, I really think, I mean, did I say this explicitly on the program? I went on Viewpoint last night with Elliot Spitzer. And I don't think I actually really, well, I think I did get a chance to say this aspect of it. I now convolute conversations I have on Ring of Fire in the green room and on shows and on this show. And also in the office and when I go home and talk on the phone, because basically I really don't discuss anything else except for politics. My life has become so narrow at this point. And I did hear from Marin yesterday, and he wanted to talk about Paul Ryan. That was about it. Nothing else. Just, hey, what's up with Paul Ryan? That was it. Apparently he had to make a joke about it. So, be that as it may, I think I made clear my opinion yesterday that this pick of Paul Ryan by Mitt Romney was perhaps one of the most Romney-esque things that Romney does. I really do believe that his pick was an acknowledgement that he's probably going to lose. And that in picking Paul Ryan, what he was doing was hedging against what appears to be, or what appeared to be, not only his eventual loss, but his eventual drubbing. And not just his drubbing, but going down in history as one of the biggest Republican losers ever. Because there was a real sense, I mean, look, if President Obama wins, it is going to fly in the face of the political scientists' projections as to how well a president should do in this type of economic situation. And Mitt Romney's campaign has been a joke every single step of the way. You want the latest? I mean, just aside from Paul Ryan? What if I was to tell you that Barack Obama held a campaign event at a business owned by a convicted drug dealer, a convicted cocaine dealer? I mean, listen, if that was the story today, do you think you could turn on your TV and see anything but that? No, of course not. Well, yesterday, Mitt Romney held a campaign event at a Miami juice shop owned by a convicted cocaine trafficker. He appeared at El Palacio de los Hugos, owned by Ronaldo Bermudez. Court records show that Bermudez pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to distribute cocaine in 1999, served 3 years in federal prison. Apparently they brought in, I don't know, almost 3,000 pounds of cocaine in a container of soap from Venezuela. Now, look, put aside questions of whether or not drugs should be legalized. Put aside questions as to whether or not convicted felons should be able to lead their lives after they've served their time in prison. Because I personally believe that to be the case. I don't believe that if someone has served their time and have not committed any crimes since, that this should not be in any way preclude them from engaging in activities, engaging in our political process. But certainly Mitt Romney's campaign couldn't have said, we want to go. We need to find a place to campaign. Let's go find a business owner's, you know, of course they want to do a small business owner, but these guys are just, they're not even aware of, like, maybe we should vet in this situation. They're just a bad campaign. And of course, the irony is that Charlie Crist had allowed convicted felons after they had served their time and come out to vote, which I believe they have a right to do and they should be allowed to do. And of course, Rick Scott, in a, I guess what is a triple irony, seeing as how this guy had to plead the fifth, I don't know, what was it, 100 times in the case against his company, which paid a $1.3-some-odd billion fine for Medicaid fraud. Rick Scott, Lex Luthor, by executive order, has now prohibited convicted felons from voting. So Mitt Romney goes to a guy's business who is not allowed to vote in Florida because of the Republican governor. And having left Paul Ryan behind somewhere in middle America because Paul Ryan can't go to Florida because he wants to destroy Medicare. This is just to show you how bad Mitt Romney's campaign is. It's bad. They're just not good at it. And he's an idiot. But Mitt Romney was looking at a loss in November and then just months of pounding by the conservative right in this country. They would call him a flip-flopper. They would call him a horrible campaigner. They would point to every single gaffe. There are too many gaffes. And I'm speaking as someone who is in the business of making money off of gaffes like politicians like this. In the crassest form, that's what people of my ilk do. And it's ridiculous. If I charged, instead of a membership for the show, per Romney gaffe, I would be doing much better than I'm doing now. So Mitt Romney wanted to avoid going down in history as one of the worst presidential candidates in modern times. I mean, imagine the way that people sort of disparaged Dukakis. And then up that times two or three, because there would be a real agenda on the right to disparage Romney in any way they could. So faced with this, what does he do? Well, he hedges his bets. Paul Ryan may not be a big upside for me, but what he does is he mitigates my losses. If I lose now, I have brought the conservative movement on board, and we all go over this cliff together. So I will not take as much crap in my loss. I will not go down in infamy. I will not have that picture of me in a tank with a helmet on that people can mock for years to years to come. That, I am convinced, is why Romney made this pick. And I do think it was Romney. He runs his campaign. And you see a tremendous amount of evidence about this. Because you now have Republican operatives blasting this pick. Just blasting this pick. You've got Republicans in tight races on defense over Ryan in the New York Times. You've got Republican candidates across the country down ticket now running away. Remember, every Republican in the Congress, was it every Republican except for maybe a handful, voted for the Paul Ryan plan to destroy Medicare, to cut all government functions by somewhere 15-20%, to throw literally tens of millions of children and elderly off the Medicare and Medicaid rolls. Best case scenario. I mean, that's what the plan says it does. Never mind the implications of having a bunch of 65, 70-year-olds, 75-year-olds trying to get private insurance on the private insurance market. It raises defense, and it also cuts taxes on millionaires. I mean, remember, this is a plan that is so egregious that when Democratic pollsters did focus groups and tried to tie Romney to this plan, the response from focus group testers was,
we don't believe there is such a plan that a politician would embrace. And so you have Republicans across the country running from it now. There was a Politico, GOP pros fret over Paul Ryan. Here's some of the quotes from this. Well, the piece says, many of these people don't care that much about Romney. They always felt he faced an improbable path to victory, but are worried that Ryan's vocal views about overhauling Medicare will be a millstone for other GOP candidates in critical House Senate races. In other words, we're just supposed to transmit this to our red meat eaters. We're not supposed to put this out in front to the American people. I will repeat what I have said since Michelle Bachmann spoke to the Tea Party in response to President Obama's State of the Union address, where she looked into the Tea Party camera and the rest of America saw her looking off into space and thought she was crazy. You cannot speak simultaneously to the Tea Party and to the American public and not look crazy to one of them. Continuing, they're worried about inviting Medicare, usually death of Republicans, into the campaign. They're worried sidetracks the job issue. They're worried he'll expose the fact that Romney doesn't have a budget plan. Most of all, they're worried that Romney was on track to lose anyway, and now that feels all but certain. Quote, I think it's a very bold choice and an exciting and interesting pick. It's going to elevate the campaign and into a debate over big ideas. It means Romney Ryan can run on principles and provide some real direction and vision for the Republican Party and probably lose. Maybe big. Said a Bush senior advisor, Mark McKinnon. In other words, we're going to have this big ideological fight and we're going to lose it because of it. This could be the defining moment of the campaign. If they win the battle to define Medicare, then I believe Romney wins the presidency. If they lose it, then they lose big in the fall, said an unnamed strategist. Very not helpful down ballot. Very, said one top Republican consultant. This is the day the music died, said one Republican operative involved in 2012 races after the rollout. Said the operative, said every House candidate is now racing to get ahead of this issue. Another strategist emailed midway through Romney and Ryan's first joint event Saturday. The good news is this ticket now has a vision. The bad news is the vision is basically just a chart of numbers used to justify policies that are extremely unpopular, end quote. So now we have gone from what was a failed attempt at a referendum on Obama to now a referendum on the Republican vision, the right-wing vision in this country, which includes cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, cutting government services, raising defense spending, cutting tax on millionaires. And so this is why the Paul Ryan pick is actually an opportunity not for Obama to win. I've always thought that was going to happen anyways. But now there's an opportunity for progressives who are concerned about Obama's intentions following the election, who are concerned about a grand bargain, who are concerned about the notion that President Obama is willing to cut Social Security and Medicare to strike a deal with the Republicans. This is now an opportunity for us to fight that battle that's going to take place 6 months from now, 8 months from now, 12 months from now, 36 months from now, over the next session of Congress. And if you don't believe that they're aware of the potential for this election to confine Obama's chance to move on this grand bargain after the election, I've got this for you. One,
I present as evidence here in my stack is a piece from August 7th, 2012 by the New York Times. I didn't even read the whole piece. Obama is an avid reader and critic of the news. I don't know, one of these pieces. But this is a story that was clearly written to get the following paragraph out there. The news media has played a crucial role in Mr. Obama's career, helping to make him a national star not long after he had been an anonymous state legislator. As president, however, he has come to believe the news media have had a role in frustrating his ambitions to change the terms of the country's political discussions. He particularly believes that Democrats do not receive enough credit for their willingness to accept cuts in Medicare and Social Security, while Republicans oppose almost any tax increase to reduce the deficit. We know that President Obama had put cuts to Social Security and Medicare, cuts to Social Security in the form of chaining the CPI, how we calculate cost of living increases, raising the eligibility age for Medicare. We know that he had put that on the table. He was willing to accept that deal. He had basically come to terms with John Boehner for supposedly $800 billion worth of tax increases that, in fact, were all based on Laffer curve math anyways. But put that aside for a moment. We know that's the case. And now we see this story come out in the New York Times, supposedly saying that Paul Ryan was the biggest roadblock to coming to terms on the grand bargain. This comes out just days afterwards. Who is pushing this meme? Well, of course, it's the administration. Elements in the administration who want that grand bargain after November. Who, rather than seeing this as an opportunity to get a mandate to go forward with non-austerity policies, to go forward with policies that say we need to tax the rich, policies that say we need to protect Social Security and Medicare at all costs, they see this as an opportunity to open up the door for a grand bargain. A grand bargain that comes in the form of Erskine Bowles, of the Bowles-Simpson-Bowles memo. They didn't have a commission report, of course, because they couldn't get enough people to sign on to it. And Erskine Bowles is rumored to be the next Treasury Secretary. And remember now, it was President Obama who helped create the notion that Paul Ryan was the intellectual pillar of the Republican Party. He is the one who, in early 2009, I believe it was, brought Paul Ryan into this national health care, maybe it was mid-2009, this national health care debate. Remember that live, televised, sort of roundtable debate? Paul Ryan was the guy coming in with his plan to destroy Medicare. The reason why President Obama brought in Paul Ryan, the most extreme right-wing ideologue, corporatist, not deficit hawk, fake deficit hawk, because he never cared about the deficit. He didn't care about it when he was voting off of those deficit-creating plans during the Bush administration. And his plan itself does not reduce the deficit. All it does is shrink the size of government. And it offsets that shrinking size in government with cuts to shrinking the revenue base. In other words, tax cuts for millionaires. And by bringing Paul Ryan into that debate, it created space and moved the center of that debate towards the right. And then President Obama appoints Alan Simpson, longtime foe of Social Security, longtime foe of Medicare, Republican, former senator, and appoints a co-chair, a Clintonite Democrat, corporatist, who also favored the privatization, i.e. the death of Social Security, a guy named Erskine Bowles. And if you have any question as to where Erskine Bowles, rumored to be the next Treasury Secretary, where he stands on this divide, listen to this clip of Erskine Bowles from 2011, 8 months ago, 9 months ago, talking about Paul Ryan and Paul Ryan's budget plan, which is now so toxic that we already have over a half a dozen Republican candidates, Senate and House, running from this. Some of whom even voted for it are now saying, well, that vote was a mistake. Here's Erskine Bowles.
Any of you all met Paul Ryan? We should get him to come to the university. I'm telling you, this guy is amazing. I always thought I was okay with arithmetic. This guy can run circles around me. And he is honest. He is straightforward. He is sincere. And the budget he came forward with is just like Paul Ryan. It is a sensible, straightforward, honest, serious budget. And it cut the budget deficit just like we did by $4 trillion. The president came out with his own plan. And the president, as you remember, came out with a budget. And I don't think anybody took that budget very seriously. The Senate voted against it 97-0. He therefore, after a lot of pressure from folks like me, he came out with a new budget framework. And in that new budget framework, he cut the budget deficit by $4 trillion over 12 years. And to be candid, this $4 trillion cut was very heavily back-end loaded. So if you looked at it on a 10-year basis and compared apples to apples, it really was about a $2.5 trillion cut.
So there you have it, Erskine Bowles singing the praises of Paul Ryan as being a legitimate, serious individual, while now every single person who has crunched the numbers on Paul Ryan's budget says it's a joke. It's a joke. So here is the opportunity that we have as progressives. This campaign, if you want to do something, you want to tweet something, must repeat over and over again that when Obama wins, it is a vote against cutting Social Security and Medicare. I don't care if that's not Obama's position. We can say it's a vote against Paul Ryan. It's a vote against Mitt Romney. And why are people voting against Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney? Because they want to maintain the integrity of our Medicare and our Social Security system. And that means no cuts. No cuts are necessary. Erskine Bowles has wanted to privatize Social Security years and years and years. I think he's now, not uncoincidentally, on the board of directors of, is it Morgan Stanley? Is it Chase? I don't know who it is. The man's a banker. And we all know why bankers, investment bankers, want Social Security privatized. Because guess who makes all the fees? Guess whose stock market gets propped up? So this is an opportunity for progressives who have otherwise not been terribly enthused between picking between Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Because we can now define who is Tweedledee and who is Tweedledum. And that's a very important opportunity for us. All right, folks. You know, speaking of Tweedledee and Tweedledum, become a member for the Majority Report, or a supporter of the Majority Report, I should say. If you can afford to, it is one way to make sure that you continue to get the free show. I mean, we call it free, but maybe it's not really free. Maybe it's just unpaid for by those of you who don't pay for it. We have, you know, literally every day we get an email from someone who, well, maybe a couple of times a week, who write in very apologetically that they cannot support the show anymore because they are going through financial hardship, serious financial hardship. And it is doubly heartbreaking breaking to me, one, to hear these stories, and two, that they feel compelled to be apologetic in this situation. Because I hate the notion that people have to feel like they apologize they have to apologize when they run into these troubles. And of course, we work out situations with them, and that offer stands for anybody who has any type of financial hardship. Write in at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we'll work out a deal with you. For those of you who enjoy the show and listen to it on a regular basis, and you can afford to support the show, even if you don't want the extra content, you are keeping the show around for those people who cannot pay for it, and keeping the show around for yourself. So please, if you can afford to become a member, and only if you can afford to become a member, join today at majority.fm. There are other ways of supporting the show, of course, and, you know, ranging from going and getting your free Audible book when we have Audible advertising at audiblepodcast.com/majorityreport, I guess it is, and buying justcoffee.coop, get the Majority Report blend, coupon code 10% off Majority. Buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link, majority.fm/support the show. Find it there. Just click on it. Bookmark it. Always buy your crap there. Giving us a review on iTunes. Donating a tweet or a Facebook post a day or a week at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. All these different ways of supporting the show. But going forward, keeping the show alive, we really need your support. So become a member, become a supporter, whatever you want to call it. Relative to the other stuff you pay for in your daily life, do that cost-benefit analysis. See what you value more, and are you supporting those things that you want to that you value more? All right, see you in the better half. In the better half, GOP already issues a memo reinforcing my point about their concerns about Medicare. Again, just reinforces the point of how much opportunity there is for those of us who want to defend Medicare and Social Security to use this election to our benefit. This incredible story about a nuclear reactor that was shut down, and what is missing from that story? TSA in Boston, they are not just profiling for terrorists, they're profiling for black and brown people. Isn't that wonderful? And, well, we got a couple other stories, but we'll take your phone call, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, on the 77th anniversary of Social Security. Thanks for reminding me. Also, you can IM us at Majority FM or through most email IM clients or through majorityfm@jabber.org. Through any email, IM client. All right, seeing the better half.